S13 is a really sweet deal. But he should get a mini.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the City Council meeting, City of Arroyo Grande, for Tuesday, September 11th. Roll call, please.
Councilmember Costello.
Here.
Councilmember Guthrie.
Here.
Councilmember Fellows.
Here.
Mayor Pro Tem Arnold.
Here.
And Mayor Ferrara.
Here. Item 3 is our flag salute. We're pleased this evening to have Boy Scout Troop 413 to lead us in the flag salute. And if you would please remain standing, our invocation this evening will be given by Pastor Randy Wimmett from St. John's Lutheran Church. Gentlemen.
Color guard attention. Audience attention. Color guard advance. Please face the flag. Salute. Please join me in the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Let us pray. Oh, for our children's children. And even as our leaders debate our continued military actions, we humbly but earnestly ask for your hand of protection over the innocent children, families, and citizens, and for a shield of rest and safety for our military, our soldiers, and for a lasting peace in the hearts and on the ground of Iraq and Afghanistan. And gracious Lord, may your spirit be in the breath of our city councilors tonight, that all words and thoughts at this meeting may be for the greater good. In your holy and precious name we pray. Amen.
Thank you, Pastor. All right, gentlemen, before you leave, don't go yet. I'm not sure if you're aware of our procedure here, but if you lead us in the flag salute, we give you some airtime on television over there by the microphone. You get to walk over to the podium and tell us a little bit about what Troop 413 has been doing lately. You want to do that for us? Yeah, you can pull that microphone down. There you go.
Well, I am a Star Scout from Troop 413. I am also a patrol leader of my patrol. Us in Troop 413, we like to go on campouts and go rock climbing and go kayaking and all this other fun stuff. And recently, we just got back from Cherry Valley over the summer, which on Catalina Island, which was really fun. We're planning a kayaking campout trip with everyone in our troop. And that's going to be really fun because we're going to go down to Morro Bay.
And did we get your name just for the record here?
Yeah, my name is Jacob Milbrandt.
Okay, Jacob, thank you. Anybody else?
Tell us exactly what you're doing. Exactly.
Okay.
My name is Trent Diaz. I'm the patrol leader of my patrol, and I'm a first-class scout. Recently, our scoutmaster restarted the Scoutorama, which had not been going on for quite a few years, and he's brought it back to our town, and that's a plus. We do lots of campouts and patrol activities and troop activities, and we keep each other together as kind of like a family, and we know each other like family. We try not to be, you know, prejudiced to anybody. That's it.
Okay, thank you. Anybody else? Well, I have an idea. I think it'd probably be best if you guys come up here and sit in our chairs, and we'll go kayaking and camping and all of those things, fun things that you guys do. You have much more fun than we do. But thank you for being here, and we hope to see you back for another flag salute in the future. So thanks for being here tonight. Good. Before we go any farther, a couple of quick announcements. First of all, the council met in closed session this evening, with the exception of one person, and that was me, as five special presentations, and we do indeed have two very special presentations this evening. They are mayor commendations, and they are for two of our employees. And as you have heard on many occasions, we have a program here in the city of Arroyo Grande that we call the Platinum Service Club, where we recognize employees of the city who serve what we call above and beyond the call of duty in service to the city. And so this evening I would ask Jeremy Kaufman and also Teresa McClish to meet me at the podium. Jeremy, good evening. We tried to do this once before,
yes, we did.
So I hope everything is better.
Yes.
Okay. Jeremy, it's a privilege this evening to recognize you. Jeremy has worked with the City of Public Works here in Arroyo Grande in the Utilities Division as a maintenance worker since August of 1997. He's currently a maintenance worker 3. He's one of the most productive water meter readers we have, and he averages over 600 meters per day. And he's recently developed a recommendation, save the city a ton of money, no pun intended. We had some extra dirt laying around the city, and it would have cost us about $6,000 if we would have taken it to Cold Canyon Landfill. And with a little bit of research, Jeremy found out that we could, in fact, take it to Santa Maria. And so we managed to save $6,000, and he's also come forth with the recommendation for some safety improvements at the Corporation Yard, which we will be hopefully implementing soon. So, Jeffrey, it's my pleasure to present this mayor commendation on this 11th day of September 2007 in recognition of your membership in the Platinum Service Club for service above and beyond the call of duty. So I'll give this to you at this time. This is a gift certificate in town. It's for you and a guest and the mayor. To go along, so yes. So thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Would you like to say something? It's your turn, Teresa. Well, this is particularly special for me because Teresa's been helping me out a great deal with a very important issue in the city. Teresa's worked with the city since April of 2000, first as an assistant planner and then as an associate planner in April 2001. Teresa has consistently done an outstanding job handling a wide variety of important and sensitive projects, but we want to focus on two things that she's doing right now that is extremely important to the city. First, she's coordinated the development of the Creek Study, our Memorandum of Understanding for the Arroyo Grande Creek Watershed and the Creek Setback Ordinance. This took an extraordinary amount of coordination and work and time over and above. The approval went very smoothly, largely due to the amount of community involvement that Teresa championed and organized. Resolved a tremendous number of issues. And secondly, she coordinated the preparation of the Newsom Springs EIR. And if you've been following that, you know what a challenge that has been. Okay, let me guess. We haven't fixed the air conditioner in here yet. Okay. Did I just hear it come on? Oh, that's a fire engine starting up. I was going to say, if we put a powerful motor in that air conditioner, it'd probably sound just like that. All right, that will take us to item 6, agenda review. Move that all ordinances presented for introduction or adoption be read in title only, and all further readings be waived.
So moved.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Discussion? Hearing none. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion carries. This will take us to item 7, community comments and suggestions. This is an opportunity for members of the public to come forward and offer any suggestions, recommendations, comments, announcements relative to items that are not on this evening's agenda. The Brown Act restricts the council from taking any action on items not published on the agenda. We would ask any member that would like to come forward to be mindful of the 3-minute rule. Please address the council as a whole. Anyone who would like to come forward? Yes, sir. Please come forward if you would. State your name.
Thank you, Mayor, and members of the council. My name is Jesse Arnold. I live in Cambria. Is there a warning light or something that'll let me know when I'm getting to the end of my time?
I'll give you a kind of a heads up, okay. Thumbs down.
Anyway, I'm here to speak about the need for labeling of genetically engineered crops to protect the consumers in your city. And I'd like to ask you to support labeling both nationally. The federal government takes control of that, but I think you could also state your support for labeling at local farmers markets and farm stands. And a crop I want to talk about that's genetically engineered to use as an example today is a crop called BT corn that was developed by the Monsanto company. And they took a gene from a soil bacteria that produces a toxin that kills the corn earworm. So it's very handy. They can just engineer that gene in. It's in every cell of the plant, in every cell of the corn that you eat afterwards. And it produces the toxin that kills the earworm. Since it does have this toxic property, it's registered with the EPA as an insecticide. Oddly enough, it's also been approved by the FDA for human consumption. So Monsanto, the company that developed it, I think you can understand, is against labeling of this product because they don't want to be held liable if something goes wrong. And also I think they realize that if people knew there was a bacterial toxin in the corn, they would be less likely to buy it. So I've given you a handout there which points out that the health officer of our county, Dr. Greg Thomas, is in favor of labeling, and I think I'm guessing that a majority of your constituents would favor labeling. And if you have to choose between who's more interested in protecting our health, our county health officer, or the Monsanto company, I hope you would agree with the health officer. Also on that same page, it does mention one local, and I'm asking you to please support labeling. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your comments. And that was pretty close to 3 minutes. Anyone else? Yes, if you would, please come forward. State your name.
My name's Shauna Galassi, and I live in Arroyo Grande. And I'm here to also urge the council members to require labeling of genetically engineered crops. I'm concerned about it, and I feel consumers have the right to know what they're buying and what they're feeding their families. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Anyone else? No one else? Okay, we will close community comments and suggestions, and we'll move to item 8, which is the consent agenda. This is a group of items, if you're following along on the agenda, that the council normally approves in one motion or one action unless there is a particular item on the agenda that a council member would like to pull for further clarification or an independent action. This evening we're talking about on the agenda consent items 8A through 8E. And this is also an opportunity for members of the public to comment on any item that's on the consent agenda. And we'll do that first. So if there is a member of the audience who would like to come forward and speak to any of the consent items, 8A through 8E, this would be an opportunity for you to do so.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Good evening, council members. My name is Jane Line. And I 265 Pleasant Lane. I come tonight as the president of the South County Historical Society, representing our consideration for membership in one of our higher membership accounts. We thank you for considering this, and we respectfully request that you consider our highest level of membership. I don't think anyone would debate the value of our 7 structures here in Arroyo Grande, and their contribution to the tourism and the local color of our city. However, probably we don't think so much about the quality of life issue that we provide, particularly with our large volunteer base when it comes to community events. We probably put more feet on the ground at every event, festival, et cetera, in this city than any other group. And we do it willingly, and we're proud of that. I think that goes to community development, to community enhancement of the lifestyle. One little anecdote that I would point out today, yesterday I had tourists stop into the Patricia Loomis Library, which we call Ruby's House, and they were from Brazil. And the young man owned a furniture store in Sao Paulo, and they were looking at this old house, and they read the bronze plaque, and they figured out the house was 119 years old, and he wanted to know what kind of wood was being used to build homes in California 119 years ago. And when he came in, he saw the redwood trim, and he just started rubbing it, and he said, "What is this?"
Good evening. I'm Mark Vasquez. I'm representing, I'd like to talk about item 8E. I'm the representative for Tony Janowitz. We would like to request that the council pull this item and reconsider the action that's recommended tonight. We would request that the council change your tentative action to a continuance to try to work out the issues regarding this particular project and hopefully move it to completion in the near future. So that would be our request.
Okay, thank you. Anyone else?
Good evening. My name is Tony Janowitz. I am the applicant for 795 Cherry Street. I also would like to ask for a continuance to talk about this project, which I think can be resolved with some good plans, which I have, and your vast knowledge and input to these plans. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Anyone else? Okay, last call. We'll close public comment on the consent agenda, bring this back to the council. And what is the will of the council this evening? Any items to be pulled?
I'd like to pull 8E, please.
Okay, 8E. Any others?
Let's pull 8D, please.
Okay. All right. If there are no other items to be pulled, I'll entertain a motion to approve consent items 8A through 8E with the exception of 8D and E.
So moved.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Discussion? Hearing none. Anything to read on those three, Tim?
No, Mayor.
Okay. Roll call, please.
Mayor Pro Tem Costello, Council Member Costello?
Yes.
Council Member Guthrie?
Yes.
Council Member Fellows?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Arnold?
Yes.
And Mayor Ferrara?
Yes. Thank you. I know we've already taken action on it, but I just wanted to make a comment, quick comment, Steve, on 8C. I know you and Angie probably teamed on that sales tax report. I just want to let you know, good job. Okay, 8D. That would be, well, you both jumped in. Okay, but, Councilmember Fellows, I think you were the one that brought this to us first.
Yeah, I just want to take a moment to give you another plug or to make another plug on behalf of the society. The more that the members of the community are involved with the society, I think the more they realize that there's an awful lot done by the society that certainly benefits the whole community, especially, I believe, the folks that run the businesses, the mom and pops that run the businesses in the village, bringing more and more people in as time goes by, as people realize that there are 7 restored, beautiful historic buildings. Most of which are open. I think they're all open at various times. Most of which are open regularly, so that publications like the Automobile Club can let people know that they should visit our city. Just today,
Quincy.
And I know that they do a tremendous amount to support us, and I think that it is worth our while to support them. Certainly, if not at the highest level, I would certainly go for the mid-level, the gold membership at the very least.
Okay. Any comments over here? Councilmember Guthrie?
I guess I'll take the other side of this, and while I certainly recognize that the Historical Society has done tremendous things for this community, I do have real concerns about where we are going to be on the operational side of our budget throughout this year. So I'm certainly in favor in some format indicating our partnership there and willingness to move forward. And at the end of the year, if in fact we're in great budget shape, I'd be more than willing to do the $5,000 level. But I have real concerns that we're going to be looking at some other cuts in the budget possibly this year, and that we should be very conservative, and I think staff's approach is a proper one here. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Mayor Pro Tem?
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. This is a very difficult one for me because there's no disputing the value of the Historical Society. At the same token, I'm very mindful of our budget. So I think what I would like to see us do is to go to the $2,500 level now, with the thought that we would be trying to move to the $5,000 next year if possible, when we see how this year shakes out.
Okay, thank you. A couple of thoughts came to mind on this, and I kind of focused on the last paragraph in the staff report, and what came to mind, I think, is perhaps a misconception that the Historical Society provides services to the city of Arroyo Grande and nowhere else, and that simply isn't true. They do have assistance and outreach that they provide to South County. And that's why they're titled as such. The other thing that I think we need to focus on is not only all of the things that Jane mentioned a moment ago with regard to the services, but we need to look at them as a research resource, if you will, for our own historical resources committee. And I think it's been fairly obvious that they provide service and they have resources that we do not have. And in terms of ensuring that the information that's put forth by our HRC is accurate, the work that they do in conjunction with the Historical Society, I think, is very valuable. And when I look at the list of organizations that we have here, the Visitors and Conference Bureau, and I'm sorry, but I have to say it, the Economic Vitality Corporation, I'm not going to dispute the VCB, but I'm certainly going to dispute the EVC and the value that we derive or don't derive from that organization. And I think if we look at the service and the effort that the Historical Society has put forth on the ground in our city, they provide much more value, I think, than the EVC does. I'm not suggesting that reevaluate the $5,000 level at the end of the year and support the $2,500 gold membership now. I can go along with that. I would ultimately like to see us support the platinum membership or the Historical Society at the platinum membership level. So those are my comments. I truly believe we need to get behind our own historical society and recognize the good service that they provide. So with that, I will entertain a motion for 8D. If there are no other comments. Did you have other comments?
I was just going to make a motion.
Oh, okay.
Mr. Mayor, you brought something up that I hadn't thought of before. Is there a procedure? Is it possible at this time to move some money over from EVC, or has it already gone over to the Historical Society?
Well, I think that's probably a separate issue that we would have to take up. In all fairness, I think we would have to probably spend time discussing specifically the value derived from EVC, and then make a determination.
Well, if I know that we might do that in the future, I would be able to support 2,500 membership level now and perhaps kick it up a notch later on in the year.
My motion that I was thinking of, that we do the $2,500 membership with the idea that we would specifically look at it when we reviewed the when we did the budget review for what will actually be, I guess, 78-79 year review. I always have trouble because we split them in the middle of the year. But
well, I just want to add one other caution is one of the issues was EVC and those other organizations are funded from housing monies and from redevelopment monies. So I'd have to we'd have to take a close look. My first reaction was I didn't think this would qualify for those particular funding and would have to come out of the general fund, which is why we had a little more conservative approach to reviewing this particular request. But, you know, we could study that further.
My motion wasn't going to be dependent on the EVC at all. It was just simply going to be that we would look at it when we review the budget because we'll know far stronger feeling about where we are with this year's budget by the time we review it at the end of the year. So we would be looking at $2,500 now with a specific plan that we'd be looking to go to $5,000 in the next budget.
All right, is that a motion?
Yes.
Is that a second?
Second.
Okay. Now let me clarify something. I was simply offering a value judgment and an observation at this time. I wasn't making a recommendation that we identify a particular source to switch money and rechannel money to another organization, but I think you all know how I feel about the EVC. Yes, you do. we have a motion and a second. Any other discussion? Hearing none, roll call.
Councilmember Guthrie?
Yes.
Councilmember Fellows?
Yes.
Councilmember Costello?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Arnold?
Yes.
And Mayor Ferrara?
Yes. Mayor Pro Tem, 8E.
Yes, Mr. Mayor. I asked to have this pulled because I had a chance to meet with Mr. Janowitz out at the site after the last time we heard this issue, and he had already drawn up a new plan that was considerable. We could just have him bring back the proposal back to us, and so therefore a continuance would allow that.
Yeah, and I'll jump in on that since I think we denied this originally without prejudice with the intent of it having it come back, and since it did come to us in the form of an appeal, we took the last action on it, and so I think your observations are accurate, and that's something I can support. Anybody else?
No problem with that at all.
I have no problem with it.
Okay. You want to make a motion, Mayor Pro Tem?
Yes, Mr. Mayor. I propose that we continue consideration of plot plan review case number 06-009, applicant Tony Janowitz, location 795 East Cherry Avenue, to a date uncertain.
Second.
Okay. Date uncertain work for you? Or did you have a date in mind? Well, it would still be a... Okay.
That sounds
right. Okay. Do you have any comment on that, Steve?
And unfortunately, probably the first or second meeting in November is about as early as we could agendize. If they're very confident they could be ready by that time, we could go ahead and continue it to a date certain.
What's that date, then? I'll just go ahead and continue it to a date certain.
That would be November 13th.
November what?
November 13th.
November 13th. Do you have calendars present? Can you make that determination now?
Yes.
Okay. All right.
So I'll change it to a date certain of November 13th.
All right. We have a motion. Is there a second?
Yes. Second.
And discussion? Hearing none. Roll call.
Mayor Pro Tem Arnold?
Yes.
Councilmember Guthrie?
Yes.
Councilmember Costello?
Yes.
Councilmember Fellows?
Yes.
Mayor Ferrara?
Yes. Thank you. Okay, item 9, public hearings. We have none this evening. Item 10, continued business. We have none. 11 is new business. 11A is a pre-application review, 06-006, the Pike and Elm Street. Good evening. Rob, I saw you moving, but I guess it's Ryan. Okay.
Good evening, Mr. Mayor, members of the City Council. This is a pre-application review for a proposal that would construct 5 studio apartments, 4 two-bedroom townhouses, and 14 three-bedroom townhouses on approximately 1.27 acres in the office mixed-use zoning district located at the Pike and Elm. And there's also been some discussion to pursue the possibility of coordinating development with the adjacent commercial use that would result in an integrated mixed-use project. I just want to point out some corrections to the numbers in the staff report. I believe it identified 6 studio apartments. There are, in fact, 5 studio apartments being proposed. And that, in turn, reduces the number of parking spaces the development code would require to 50 as opposed to 51. And the project has been revised to add an additional surface parking space, so that brings that total to 47. And to clarify that the proposed vegetative buffer ranges in width from 47 to 50 feet, and that's on whether the project is a mixed-use project or a residential project, and that being 15 units an acre for a residential project and up to 20 units an acre for a mixed-use project. Continuing with the background, there was a previous incarnation of this project that was reviewed by the Planning Commission. At that time, the project did include a 1,000-square-foot commercial building and a 30-foot-wide on-site agricultural buffer that got them to a total of 100 feet. The Planning Commission comments for that particular project was that the agricultural buffer was the most important part of the project and should be more than the minimum that's required by the development code, and that a commercial use may not be appropriate within that agricultural buffer. Moving on to Planning Commission review of the project as it's currently proposed, the Commission did address several issues. They expressed concern with the possibility of setting a precedent for considering the coordination between an existing commercial use and a new residential development as a mixed-use project, but felt the consensus was that depending on the level of coordination with 7-Eleven, it could be appropriate to do so, and that the current proposed buffer should be adequate. The proposal for the buffer did include a masonry wall along South Elm Street. There was some discussion as to whether or not this was really necessary. And there was some discussion as to the parking situation and that some parking could be added at the expense of the buffer, and the consensus of the commission was to not do so, that the buffer was more important than any additional parking. There was also some discussion for the project to continue the bike lanes along South Elm Street and the possibility of having to restrict certain types of vehicular movements onto the Pike from the project. This is an aerial photo of the project site, the corner of the Pike and South Elm Street. And the top corner is the existing commercial use, which is a 7-Eleven convenience store. The project site, as proposed, consists of 3 parcels, as I said, totaling approximately 1.27 acres, as shown in the outlined area, wraps around the existing commercial use. In reviewing this project, I should state that when we started reviewing the project, we did so with an eye towards the pending updates to the housing ordinance that would incorporate current state law, and identified some issues and some questions that would need to be clarified accordingly. In looking at the code, we, as I said, the application of if this were to be qualified as a mixed-use project, then we would apply a maximum density to the project, 20 units an acre versus only 15 units an acre if it were a residential project. In looking at the code, there's no real definitive definition as to what threshold has to be attained in order to become a mixed-use project other than incorporating different uses. Then we looked at state law regarding density bonuses and concessions required for provision of affordable housing, and discovered that the cities, we have a density equivalency that's actually applied to multifamily projects in multifamily zones and mixed-use projects in mixed-use zones, but no density equivalency for a residential project. And in the last couple of days, staff has put together some example language that I will run through. It's rather long, but I'll just read through it. In order for a project to be eligible for mixed-use density, it shall be a project where residential and commercial or office uses are combined in a single structure or on a single site in an integrated development project with significant functional interrelationships and a coherent physical design in which both residential and non-residential uses are provided. A single site may include contiguous parcels so long as there is substantial new construction on all parcels that are part of a functionally integrated development plan. A mixed-use development project may be constructed either in a vertical manner in which the non-residential uses are located on the ground floor level and the residential uses are on the upper levels, or in a horizontal manner in which the non-residential uses are located along the street frontage and residential uses are located to the rear of the non-residential uses. And again, that's just some example language that could further clarify what a project has to do to qualify as mixed use. In running some of the numbers based on recent changes to state law, we have two scenarios. One assumes a mixed-use project with a starting density of 20 units an acre, and I'll run through those numbers now. And it's important to keep in mind that all of these numbers are equivalent units based on the table that's within the development code. So based on the project size of 1.27 acres, we start off with a maximum density of 25 total units. If the base project were to consist of 24 and a half units, and again, they get down to half units because the density equivalency for studios are half unit, then 2.5 of the 24 and a half units would be deed restricted for low income category affordable housing. That qualifies as 10% of the total project. State law then entitles the project to a 20% density bonus when applied to the original 24 and a half units. And we have to round up based on state law. It gets us to 30 units. However, the project as proposed with the equivalency comes out to 27 and a half total units. Now moving on to the residential. So these are all just one-to-one numbers. There's no equivalency applied. We start with a maximum density of 19 units for the site. At 19 units, 5 now would be affordable because the studios are no longer a half unit. They're one unit. And again, that would be the low-income category. This boosts the percentage of the project that would be affordable to 26%. And state law entitles the 20% bonus plus 1.5% for every 1% over 20 with a cap at 35%. So that cap would apply here. It would get them to 26 total units allowed on the project. However, without the equivalency applied, they're at 23 total units. And as I mentioned earlier, when running through these numbers, we did discover what could be interpreted as a discrepancy in the development code, where we have equivalent densities applied to multifamily projects and multifamily zones, mixed-use projects and mixed-use zones, but no such equivalency for a residential project in a mixed-use zone. Just further analyzing the two scenarios. As mentioned, the total proposed project density would be allowed under either of those scenarios, given the numbers and types of units proposed. And to reiterate, a residential project is allowed in the office mixed-use zoning district. However, the intent of that section does encourage office and commercial uses that support residential uses. Some considerations for the project from a staff's perspective is that the pursuit of a mixed-use designation does provide the incentive to improve an existing commercial use, which may otherwise remain unchanged into the foreseeable future. And the agricultural buffer does reduce available street frontage where commercial office uses would normally be located along South Elm Street. Now we get to the concession. Those numbers, the development code would require 50 parking spaces based on this project. However, state law would reduce that number to 41 parking spaces, and the project, as proposed, includes 47 spaces. Moving on to the agricultural buffer. The code does require a minimum 100-foot buffer between residential and agricultural uses. I will point out that approximately 75% of the property that's zoned for agricultural use across the street from the project is actually currently used as a cemetery, with the agricultural use a little further south. And the project does propose an on-site vegetative buffer ranging from 47 to 50 feet wide. This also includes a driveway access to South Elm Street and limited parking on either side. So when you add this together to the 70-foot right-of-way of South Elm Street, we've got a buffer of 117 to 20 feet between the ag zone property and the nearest residential units. This conceptual landscape plan does illustrate the buffer area. It has been designed to include a pocket park within the buffer. I'll just mention that during the Planning Commission review, the consensus appeared to be to do away with the park and dedicate the buffer entirely to a passive use and not have any activities take place within the buffer. With that, a recommendation is for Council to review and comment on the proposed project and provide direction to staff and applicant, and also to provide direction to staff regarding any potential development code amendments that would provide both clarification on mixed-use projects and density, and also any amendments that would clarify or apply density equivalencies to residential projects in a mixed-use zone. And with that, I will try to answer any questions at this time.
Okay. Questions or clarifications in the staff report? Mayor Pro Tem.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I'm going to talk a little bit about the ag care buffer. What was the Planning Commission's logic to enlarge the buffer so much on this parcel? Because between the cemetery and the minor amount of frontage that's actually this project has on it, and the fact that there all the existing properties developed out, I'm trying, and the fact that the previous project was approved at 100 feet, I'm confused as to why we're up to such a large buffer on this project.
I don't want to speak for the whole commission, but I believe they were looking at it that in regards to the previously approved project that had the minimum buffer, is that the whole buffer issue wasn't really fleshed out at that time, and maybe now that there's more information and more policy direction emphasizing that the 100-foot is a minimum, and they just went beyond that based on available information as to what is adequate. As far as the cemetery use, I think they just looked at the language of the for the ag buffer that does state that it be measured from the property line. The entire site is zoned ag, although, as I said, it is a portion of it is used as a cemetery, but it's still technically zoned ag.
That's all I have right now. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Councilmember Costello.
Ryan, exactly what improvement is proposed for the existing?
So on the right-hand side of the image, I can't tell where the cemetery ends and the ag begins.
From the aerial, it's approximately the cemetery is surrounded by all the eucalyptus trees. So even though it's a black and white photo, it doesn't really show there. Oh, there we go. So this canopy here roughly outlines the cemetery area. And then within the canopy, if you were to drive out, there's it's like a little wire fence around the actual burial grounds.
Thanks. Could you go back to one of your slides that contrasts where you have, I think it's density equivalence, except not for or density bonuses or whatever.
Is it
right there? Okay. So I think if I understood you correctly, the third dash, no equivalent densities are applied to residential projects. In your opinion as a planner, is that an omission, an error that should be corrected? And let me ask you, well, go ahead and answer that first.
I can kind of see both sides of it. In regards to applying the equivalency to a mixed-use project, it does lower the unit count if you provide studio and one-bedroom units, which could be viewed as an incentive to put smaller units within a mixed-use project. Whether we want to apply that same standard to an all-residential project, is that we do have an equivalency in the mixed-use zoning district for mixed-use projects. However, I don't think there's a big a penalty on that density equivalency when you get into the larger bedroom sizes, such as in the mixed-use district, if you had a four-bedroom unit, you're at two equivalent units. So there's the incentive and then a disincentive to provide smaller units in a mixed-use project, and that could be carried over to residential projects in a mixed-use zone, or since it's a residential project, we could just apply the equivalent density from the mixed-use zone that would apply strictly to residential projects.
Just realize you and Rob must work in the same office or close by, right?
Pretty close.
A good explanation, but a long one. And then I was a little confused on one other slide where you talked about density bonuses or equivalents for affordable projects. And I think you said that the whole project didn't have to be affordable to get some density bonuses or parking reductions and so on.
No, it's the state law is pretty clear that when doing these calculations, you start with what would be considered a base project, which would include your affordable units. You take that number of affordable units, divide it by the number of total units, inclusive of the affordable units, and that's your percentage. And then above and beyond that is would be your bonus units. So, for example,
it is based on the number of it's sort of proportional to the number
the
of
bonus
affordable
is,
units.
Is applied to what the base density would be for the project.
Okay, thanks. That's all.
Any other questions, clarifications for Ryan? Ryan, I do have one. Can you put the site plan sketch up there? Yeah. Perhaps we have a few questions.
Mr. Mayor, members of the City Council, my name is Steve Puglisi, project architect, 226 Encanto Avenue, Pismo Beach. I could not make a better and more concise presentation on this project than Ryan has just done. He and I have gone over the numbers. They confuse me a bit. I hope that I'm not alone in that, especially when we start applying some of the state standards. As I understand it, whether the project is mixed use or whether the project is viewed by you gentlemen as purely residential, given how state law is working on these issues, we seem to be in a fairly comfortable zone as far as ordinance and state law is concerned with the density that we're asking for. I want to back up a moment and talk about Planning Commission. We've now been before your Planning Commission conceptually twice. We took very much to heart the comments that were made to us at our first presentation, especially when the consensus of the Planning Commission was to request as extensive an agricultural buffer as we could create. I took that very literally, went to David Foote, landscape architect and colleague of mine for many years, and it is David Foote, his firma, that produced that diagram. That was not based on any pressure by me or any other individuals. Dave met with the Agricultural Commissioner's office. He and I visited the site on two occasions, read city ordinance, and this was what David came up with as an appropriate buffer for the site. Other items that the Planning Commission spoke to us about included the removal, hopefully, of all driveways off of Elm Street. That, frankly, is an impossibility. Circulation, police and fire absolutely require that we have that access, but at least one. Our original design, by the way, had two accesses onto Elm Street, and we did abandon the second. In so doing, however, the agricultural buffer, the abandonment of the second access, it became increasingly apparent to us that trying to create some additional token commercial effort exclusively on this property to satisfy the literal interpretation of mixed use was probably going to bring us to no good end. It was apparent to us in our conversations with Planning Commission that the commissioners were, some of them were frankly disinterested in any additional commercial on the site and suggested removing it entirely. Others suggested that if you're going to do commercial, do a lot of commercial, not just a little bit. And the consensus, as I remember it, and I think the staff agrees, if you are going to do commercial, even though our ordinance does not restrict you from putting it in the ag buffer, we would rather see ag buffer than we would see commercial. Rob and I vexed over this for quite a while of what to do with the, Rob Strong, with the commercial aspect of the project. And here's how we see it. We hope you as the City Council will see it as we do. this property, what you're seeing on the board right now, that is a zoning district in its entirety. That four lots, three of ours and one of the exists, one and only opportunity. I believe that has covered all of the primary issues. We're here to listen to you folks, and then hopefully, if you like where we're going with this, we're going to find our way into a full application. One other item I want to mention, my recollection of our last Planning Commission meeting, the Planning Commission, the consensus was they like the density we're proposing. I didn't see any interest on the part of the Planning Commissioners to have us reduce our density. We're very close to meeting parking standards, and by state law, we're far exceeding them. We think we've got a good working project for you right now. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for Steve?
Just one, and I'm not sure you can answer this. It has to do with total square footage. When you refer to this as a mixed-use island or zone, do you know the total square footage of what this zone would be, and particularly then what the 7-Eleven? I'm guessing the 7-Eleven is about a fifth of the entire, so it's about 20%.
I would think so. We're 1.27 acres, so maybe the whole thing is 1.5 acres.
So it's maybe even less than 20%.
Yeah, 22%, something like that.
All right, thank you.
Steve, maybe you can answer the question for me. I was concerned, or I had a question about the depth of what was proposed as the pocket park here.
I think Ryan's answer was just about right. When you look at the 70-foot, and again, this is assuming not literally where agricultural activity takes place, which is well to the south, but the property line separating the agricultural zone from our property. So that would be everything on the other side of Elm Street. You've got a 70-foot right-of-way for Elm, and then our buildings back in that area are in the 30, pardon me, they, Brian, you're going to have to help me with that. They're coming out to the maximum, maybe 45 feet on our side of the property line.
You're showing 46 on your plans.
Hey, pretty good. It was within a foot. That of that, I would say about half is where David had introduced this idea of a pocket park. Now, we still have it in mind that that agricultural buffer, heavily landscaped, if the Planning Commission is not crazy about us doing this private little park, we still would intend on having it as a landscape area. It still may have a picnic table or a little barbecue or something like that for people to go and enjoy. Bear in mind, even though it's an ag buffer, it's supposed to be something that is attractive and something visual that the folks that are going to be living here would like to participate in. We don't care whether we do it as a paved park or not. We're going to follow the suggestion of either City Council or Planning Commission on that.
Is there any other, looking at the project itself, can you conceptualize any other resident or pedestrian amenity that might weave in through the houses? You mentioned a picnic table or benches or something like that that might be integrated in here somewhere.
Only, sir, at the exclusion of the parking.
Yeah, it wasn't so much talking about a park or a recreation area so much as I was talking about, you know, I'll tell you what comes to mind here. I'm sure you're familiar with a hotel chain, the Residence Inn. Mm-hmm. If you walk through some of the housing components within those grounds, what you find in between some of the houses are sort of just a widened area. You know, picnic bench and a little gas barbecue, those kinds of amenities. And they sort of, you know, a little bit goes a long way. That's the kind of thing that I was talking about, not a park per se.
I imagine we could. These might be single user activities instead of
right.
cluster. Sure.
Right. You know, first come, first serve, family will come down and mm-hmm. cook their dinner outside, something like that.
I'm sure we could incorporate those.
Okay. Any other questions for?
I
have a quick one. Okay. Steve, how would you handle runoff, rain runoff, water runoff from the project?
I wouldn't. I'm wise enough to have hired North Coast Engineering to solve those problems for us. They already have been engaged by our client. There is a request on the table that we are exploring right now not to try to do on-site retention, but to participate with the city. There is a swale that runs down. It's actually on the other side of Elm Street, if I remember. Runs down to a much larger community basin, and we've been asked by Public Works to participate in getting our water down there instead of trying to create our own basin on site.
Okay. Councilmember Guthrie, you had a question?
I just had one additional question. This spot right here, is that also landscaped?
Yes, it is.
Okay, it's just not clear from these plans, right?
I've driven by there 100 times and more recently today, and I didn't have a chance to note. I know along the pike we have we have a fairly dense screen of eucalyptus. What I can't recall is whether or not that eucalyptus wraps around onto Elm Street. Does it, Ryan?
It does wrap around the cemetery area. There's a line of trees that make the corner. And the canopy's about right here. So it's, and it continues on all the way down the pike.
Okay, so the trees sort of end right in this area?
Yeah, right here.
Right here, all right. Thank you, Rob. Okay, I got it. Why don't you leave it off? All right, any other questions? All right, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay, this is a pre-app. The format here obviously is making observations and recommendations based on what individual council members feel about what has been presented. So why don't we start with Councilmember Guthrie?
I guess on the mixed use versus residential, I think I prefer to see this come forward with the res unit and get 2 3-bedroom units out of it. It's essentially what you can do. You do one affordable studio unit, and you then in exchange get to do 2 3-bedroom units, which is really what we're saying here. I'm not that familiar with the state law to know whether that is, whether they, knowing Sacramento, they probably didn't go to that much trouble. But that appears to be the case here. So I'm okay with that. I mean, we certainly have to follow state law. And actually, I think the density probably will work out here. It is going to essentially be a fairly dense multifamily unit in the middle of single-family residential, but we have that in other places in the city as well. So as for the park, I don't have a strong feeling either way. I think it's probably, if the landscape buffer is tall enough, that the park's probably reasonable use there, rather than leaving it. There's a part of me that says you might be better off to do the trees on the street and provide a little more parking might be another alternative. But I don't have a strong feeling either way on the park. I think the buffer's reasonable here. I do think we have to follow the policy here, though, that says, you know, that even though there's a cemetery, unless we're going to get the cemetery rezoned to a public zone, even though we all know it's not likely to be used, that in fact we do have to treat it as agriculture because that's what it's zoned. So I think the buffer's minimally meets that standard and is certainly reasonable. Thank you.
Okay, Councilmember Costello.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I'm going to echo pretty much what Mr. Guthrie just said. I agree that I don't want to see this as a commercial mixed use. I don't see the real tie into that. And I think it makes a lot more sense to look at it in terms of purely residential, that there will not be a whole lot of mixed usage of this. I used to live about 400 feet to the east of this, I guess. I'm fairly familiar with the area. I don't think the density is too great. I think that's reasonable use. If we're going to meet the state quotas and the state numbers that are provided with the densities, it works. I'd like to see a little bit more parking, but we meet what the minimums are, so I'm not going to get too concerned about that. I probably would just not see the pocket park there.
if we're going to have a buffer zone, and again, complying with the distance from the zoned agricultural area, it makes sense not to have a park there. I probably could accept the park there, though, in light of the fact that it is a cemetery and it's not actively used for agriculture. Also, the fact that the people that are farming this area do so without using pesticides. They're trying to be environmentally friendly in how they're farming there. So still, I think we do need to keep the minimum buffer in place there. So the efforts you've gone to are worthwhile keeping, and I salute you for doing them. So I have no particular problems with looking at this as a purely residential project, and I could probably support this coming forward.
Okay, thank you. Councilmember Fellows.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I was just sitting here going over the Planning Commission's comments, and I certainly agree with Mr. Keene, and also put the image up there again of the project, the proposed project. I'm almost speechless because you have an attempt at a buffer, but you have a gigantic gap in it with parking and a park, especially that parking gap. And if there were some way, and I know you're going to find fault with this, but if there were some way to have the entrance on Elm, which I know you need, according to the fire department and so on, at the far northern end, to me that wouldn't really be punching a hole in the buffer. There's pretty much a hole in that end anyway because of the parking at 7-Eleven. But I certainly couldn't support an ag buffer that hits about 40% pavement in a gigantic hole in it. Okay, what else? I had a thought that perhaps if we do approve the project, or if we're looking for a way to approve it, because I think it's a good place to have residential, is that we could perhaps look at planting landscaping with shrubs, trees, whatever, on the east side of South Elm, adjacent to the, I think there's a drainage swale or something there, or in the drainage swale, which would really kind of buff up the buffer, in my opinion, maybe make it a little bit more acceptable. And that's all. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Mayor Pro Tem.
Yes, Mayor. All right, I'm going to go over a couple issues. I think basically it's a good project, but I do have some problems with it. And the one issue I really looked at was the parking. And I understand that we're meeting state law with this project as far as parking, but I think the reason that I have a problem with it is that there's 47 spaces, but only 14 aren't covered. And so what we really end up with is 14 spaces that are left for the efficiencies or the studios, which are five, and then that leaves 9 guest parking spaces, of which when you get down to the lower portion, which would be, I guess, the western edge of the project, you have 3 realistically guest parking spots. One of them is handicapped when you pick up the other 3. So, I mean, I understand the concept of people will make it work, but there are no driveways here, so there's no ability to park there. I'm very concerned at how the lower half of this project is going to actually function, and I think it's because of the garages, and so I don't know if a solution would be that there'd be carports instead of garages, and I'm not saying I'm in favor of that because I think aesthetically they probably wouldn't look as nice. But if one spot was basically either designated, or even if both were designated for the unit, at least then the likelihood that a guest could park in one of those spots, whereas if the garage door is closed, a guest is not going to be parking in the garage. So that's my concern with the parking. So I think that is a way to get around state law as far as how I see the project working right now with parking, is I don't like the mix of the parking that we have. Let's see. I'm going to disagree completely with, I think, the majority here as far as the buffer issue goes right now. We've got organic across the street. We've got a cemetery across the street, which I'm going to venture a good guess that that's not going to change as far as the use. So when we were talking about Cherry Creek Project, we specifically were looking at a very high-intensity use drawn here. I most definitely think that a pocket park is needed here. I'm amazed that we're looking at backyards that are backing up to the homes of 10 feet as well as backing up to the 7-Eleven, and we're considering this, you know, sufficient, and then we're going to say we're not going to do anything but have a passive vegetated area that realistically isn't going to serve a purpose. I think to realistically talk about trying to not have a hole punch in this buffer onto Elm Street isn't realistic. And so, therefore, parking's got to go somewhere here. So either the homes are going to have to get into the buffer if we're going to move the parking out of there, or we're going to have parking there. So one way or the other, there's going to be a fairly big hole there. So this is a dysfunctional buffer at best. I mean, we're meeting code here, and I understand that, but we're not going to see this area ever change. We've got homes along going down further on Elm Street. So I don't see this as a critical buffer like I do Cherry Lane when we're talking about protecting an ag farm that we perceive that will be in for indefinitely because of the easement. I anticipate that this will probably remain ag as well, but it's going to be a much lower intensity use ag. So I definitely don't support not doing something with this buffer other than just having it as a lot of trees. I want to talk a little bit about just what has been discussed as far as commercial and the ag buffer, because I know when we approved the previous project, when I was on planning commission for the senior project here, we specifically had discussed the fact that if commercial wanted to go into that, that would have been a way to get closer to the road. And so I'm concerned right now that policy is being made almost on the commercial issue without us having a discussion on this. And I think that if we're going to be restricting commercial from ag buffers, I definitely want to have a discussion on this and not have this just be made ad hoc. So let's see, what else? So I think I can basically say I like the project. And I think, unfortunately, the issues that I don't like are not because of the applicant, but primarily because of the direction they've been given at previous planning commission meetings. The only other thing that I will look at and say that I'm not sure how well it's going to work because parking is so constrained is the trash dumpster being located behind 8 and 9. And I saw there was some notation about that in the planning commission meetings. I do also want to add some of the comments that were made at planning commission that I think are good. I definitely agree that the bike strip needs to be added, the bike lane. There needs to be a pedestrian access to the 7-Eleven. I would like to see the 7-Eleven enhanced so that we can try to make the stretch that these projects are tied. And I definitely want to see the affordable and the non-affordable, at least on the outside, look the same. There was some discussion about mixing them, but I believe the way this has been done, they're actually all lumped together in one spot, which I don't have a problem with. I understand they don't have direct parking. They've got to walk, so it makes they're going to be affordable. But I would like to at least see them looking similar, and I believe based on what I saw in the elevations, that was the case. That's all. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. So the configuration of those, did you want to clarify that, Steve? Yes. If you would, please come up.
As a matter of fact, our newest drawings have relocated that trash enclosure at the suggestion of the Planning Commission.
Okay. I see it. Okay. Just so you... If I understand what you just showed me, the trash receptacle would be moved here. Is that correct?
That is correct, sir.
And then, so, again, conceptually, if there were cars occupying these parking places on trash pickup, then we wouldn't have an issue there.
That is correct.
Okay, since it's moved, it's proposed to be moved across the way. All right. Okay. Well, first and foremost, I agree with the majority of the comments with regard to the zoning of this particular project or the use of this particular project. And, you know, the comments by the Mayor Pro Tem notwithstanding, I think perhaps at a later time when we look at buffer zones, we can bring that up as an issue. Because I understand that's coming back as an agenda item, and perhaps that can be on the list, is how we focus on commercial use within the buffer zone. That can we can add that to the punch list of issues or sub-issues. And but in terms of this particular project, I think just looking at the whole concept of how we design mixed use throughout the city, I tend to agree. The 7-Eleven is sort of a commercial island in and of itself. I mean, if you look around, there's very little, if any, adjacent commercial use. I'm not sure whether we were chasing the existence of that particular site with the mixed-use designation simply because it was there. But I see this project moving forward primarily as a residential project. I'm also comfortable with the fact that that even if we, you know, once again, if we look at mixed use, you know, the whole idea behind it is to design a project that would be more pedestrian friendly, that would in fact get people out of their cars. We would have service retail and other establishments nearby so that it would truly be a mixed use pedestrian oriented. I don't see this happening here. People are going to walk over to 7-Eleven, but they're not going to walk anywhere else and be able to access commercial. That brings us to the buffer zone, which I see is the real key issue here. I think most of you know I am a champion of buffer zones, but I also recall when we talked about buffer zones and putting in some guidelines and putting in some language and I think rightly so, we cannot blanket a buffer zone model that fits every case. I think we need to treat these cases separately, and we need to have perhaps a bit of common sense woven into how we design them. In this particular instance, I tend to agree that the agricultural activity directly across the street is not what we see typically existing in some of our other ag areas. There is an organic farm over there, and I think it's probably going to remain based on the circumstances that surfaced and the discussion that led to the changing of the use of pesticides and those kinds of issues. We do have additional screening over on the other side of Elm Street in the way of a tree line. And then also we have an existing row of homes down here that are no farther back than what we're proposing here and really have an open area with no ag buffer. That said, I don't know if we need as many parking places here. I certainly do not see any logical way that we could reconfigure this by closing off this street and putting another entrance and egress. And if you look at what we did at Cherry Creek, even though we don't have parking places in the buffer and we certainly don't have a pocket park, but we do have a driveway going through that accesses a neighborhood street. I just don't see any way around it for circulation. So I could probably support some parking activity out here. I don't know if we need this much. I would be mindful of and supportive of some of the comments that the Mayor Pro Tem made about perhaps looking at some other driveway configurations or parking configurations that would get us close to where we need to be. On the issue of the pocket park, I'm looking at the type of residences that we're proposing here, and I know that we're going to have some small children there. So I'm looking at not something elaborate, not something that would have a lot of playground equipment, but just an area where, a dad could go out and play catch with a kid. And a couple of picnic tables, and it doesn't have to be anything that really extends into beyond 100 feet into the ag buffer or causes the park extends in beyond the 100-foot distance line. And the last thing that I would like to see is what I mentioned a moment ago, and that is that to the degree that we can weave in some of the walkways and pathways, those kinds of pedestrian or family amenities that might make the whole project more appealing, and it can be as something as simple as a small four-person octagonal picnic bench and a gas barbecue. Something like that will really make the project, I think, a lot more appealing. And
language that we had provided you an example of earlier, dealing with a more specific definition of mixed use, and then also possibly some recommendations dealing with the inconsistency of how equivalent densities is applied currently in mixed use zones. We wanted to find out if you're interested in us doing that.
I, for one, would be interested, and I read the proposed language, and I didn't look at my colleagues over here, but I know that there's no way we could have studied that and made a determination tonight. So I'm assuming that you're going to bring that back.
Yeah, we're just interested in finding out if you'd like us to
what's the will of the council?
Bring it back for
I think that's a good idea. I'd like to see a little bit plainer language, simpler language used to make it a little bit easier to understand, and maybe break it into a paragraph or two rather than one.
Okay.
Totally can support that.
I think the example we saw was fairly decent in and of itself. So if we're going in that direction, that's the way to go.
Okay. Thank you.
The answer is yes. Okay. Very good. Then we will move to 11B, consideration of the viewshed review alternative.
Mayor, members of the council, this is somewhat similar to a pre-application discussion. We're looking for direction from the council related to the current viewshed review provisions within the code. The staff report deals with the explanation of the typical number of applications we've had annually, which generally range from 19 to 20 applications a year, 72 in the last 4 years. Several of which have been appealed to the Planning Commission and a few appealed to the Council. With each case of viewshed review involving a neighbor opposed to the granting of the minor use permit for viewshed review, there are disputes and certain findings of fact currently provided by code. And there's always debate, contention, as to whether a two-story structure is consistent with the established scale and character of a neighborhood in which it's located, or unreasonably and unnecessarily affects views of from surrounding properties. And those findings of fact are obviously judgmental. I think one of the judgments obviously has an explanation, that it's judged in light of permitting reasonable use and development of property on which the proposed structure or expansion is to occur. One other factor that probably should be specifically considered by the council is the viewshed review applies to additions, and it is not applicable to new development outside of design overlay districts. So in some instances, you can construct a two-story house that might have viewshed implications to its neighborhood on a vacant lot, but if you have a house already there, you can't build an addition without going through the view as it's currently worded. The remainder obviously is an attempt to identify some issues that viewshed review address. And I think it should be understood that it's a relatively unique process within the County of San Luis Obispo that Arroyo Grande has viewshed review provisions. Other jurisdictions do have some design review, and some have hillside standards, some have special permit processes such as coastal permits or conditional use permits required even of single-family homes that give some discretion to the jurisdiction. And because there is discretion, there have been appeals in those jurisdictions over those types of cases. So even eliminating viewshed review provisions, unless it is just a simple ministerial act, doesn't necessarily remove the contention that might occur between neighbors. We did find outside of San Luis Obispo County many other jurisdictions that have provisions similar to viewshed review, and I've cited some of them. I don't think that they're as relevant as what you intend to do locally. I point out in Arroyo Grande, the conventional residential zoning districts provide for maximum height of 30 feet or two stories, whichever is less, but the viewshed review does affect second-story additions. There's also the de-overlays that can include height restrictions within specific sub-areas, and sometimes those are variable depending upon the topography of the sub-area and the character of existing houses. But there is the inconsistency of allowing two-story new construction and regulating additions. Beyond that, I think the viewshed process has been and remains a potentially inherently subjective and dependent upon perception of scale, character, and what constitutes reasonable use or unnecessarily interfering with the scenic views. The county of San Luis Obispo has been hitting the headlines recently with their viewshed review process, and I would distinguish that. It is a public view that is considered by the county from prominent public roadways, and that is a more frequent use of viewshed. And that is one of the alternatives that the staff report addresses, that you could, without necessarily totally eliminating viewshed review, make it more of a public benefit, public view issue instead of a private versus private issue. That can be done in a variety of ways, and I don't think by suggesting this for agenda, eliminate the viewshed review entirely, as most jurisdictions choose not to protect private views because of its controversy. And that could be done with a relatively simple extraction from the code of the minor use permit process for viewshed review. Alternatively, you could reinforce some second story development with standard development regulations, which could differ for second story development than they are for single story. And other jurisdictions do this, such as a one-story development might have a 5-foot side yard. A two-story component might require 10 or 15 feet for light, circulation, privacy, screening, things of that nature. There could be some effort to specify other standards, such as a green build, that could waive the viewshed review or respond to things like floor area ratios that might be considered excessive. And I think that the other aspect of viewshed review, if you decide to retain it, you could certainly increase the number of defined criteria, such as some of those standards I just mentioned, floor area ratio, coverage, reasonable maximum size dwellings, green build compliance. All of these are essentially variations of, are you looking for public viewshed protection or private viewshed protection? Are you looking for consistent regulations of all two-story buildings? Are you looking for specific additions rather than new construction? With that, there's a broad range of combinations of these things which you could discuss, and the council might have other criteria in mind, other standards or findings that it feels would make the process less subjective. I'd have to acknowledge that early in my tenure with the city, I had discussions with the Planning Commission about the subjective nature of viewshed review and suggested that since it appeared to be a very specific, focused private versus private benefit, that I felt that the process could be simplified by eliminating the viewshed review. The commission disagreed, and I think we still have the viewshed review process because of that. So this has not yet been considered or recommended by the Planning Commission. This is responsive to a council request for direction and the staff's desire to get the direction before we take the time to spend refining alternatives that might not be intended by the council. If you have questions, I'd try to respond.
Okay.
Compromise or consideration between the neighbors, but it was primarily the private parties that would benefit, not the public agency. So they did not choose to have viewshed review.
Thanks.
Okay. Comments or questions? Comments or questions only?
Question,
okay. Go ahead.
One quick, just because I was a little confused by this. This is on the alternatives, the very first alternative where you're talking about eliminating viewshed review except where there's a public view. And it says the applications protect access to the community's scenic resources and maintain established character of single-family neighborhoods. If we're going to eliminate viewshed review except where there's a public view, how would that maintain the character of a neighborhood unless we're just defining all neighborhoods as potentially two-story? Is that essentially what you're doing?
I think that I would attempt, if there's a desire to maintain the established scale and character, that it would probably be suggested that certain quarters would deserve public viewshed protection. Perhaps certain facilities would deserve viewshed protection. Certain neighborhoods may be appropriate for design overlay restricting second-story development.
It isn't really what you're proposing is not just that we're going to just protect public views, but that we're actually going to look at each neighborhood and essentially assign some sort of an aesthetic. Okay.
We certainly could. Yeah, and I don't think I elaborated sufficiently on that. That it would require some combination of design overlays and public viewshed protection to achieve the same purposes that are discussed under viewshed review right now. We have had viewshed reviews denied in an area where it was going to be a first and only second-story addition. And I think that most of those provisions wouldn't provide that level of protection without a design overlay.
Okay. All right, thank you. I just want to clarify that. Thank you.
Okay. This is not a public hearing, but obviously it's an important issue for our community, and so I would ask any member of the public if they would like to come forward on this item. Be an opportunity for you to do so. Anyone? No one? Okay. We'll close any public comment on 11B, and we'll bring this back for final observations and comments. And once again, we'll go to Councilmember Phillips.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. The reason I brought this up originally, I think most of you know, but Councilman Arnold, I don't think, was here when I asked for it to be brought before. You were here?
I read the minutes.
Oh, okay. Is that we'd gone through a lengthy viewshed review, actually not just us, but I think the ARC, but at least the Planning Commission, that took 50 weeks, almost a year. The applicant, the Atkinsons, and then the neighbor next door, the tenants, claimed to have spent $25,000 total
on, as I recall, they went to Gehring and Taylor engineers. They had each had their own architect and so on, plus untold staff hours. And we ended up in the very end with, I'm not sure if, I don't think the tenants are very happy. In my opinion, most of their view is still gone when we were done. After I suggested bringing in, sued each other and finally resolved it. So in my opinion, if all of you believe that we should do viewship reviews, continue to do them, or in some modified form, that's okay with me. But I thought it was worth discussing. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Councilmember Costello.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I've done a lot of thinking about this since it was brought back for us. And I think that we probably want to look at protecting public views only. I think that that's perhaps an appropriate thing for us to look at. I had several discussions with the attorney, the city attorney, and talked about what are the rights. And no one has an inherent right to a view. Constitutionally, there's no such thing. I don't like the fact that we have a discrepancy between new development and additions. I think they should be evaluated equally. There should not be a differentiation or distinction between the two. And ultimately, I think when someone buys a piece of property, that they have to expect that the people around them are going to develop their properties to the limits that are expressed there, to the height limit, to the floor ratio, to what the setbacks are. And that's, you know, that's where we should be at. And any viewshed review that we do have must not be subjective. I think that we've got to get away from it being subjective. It has to be objective. So if we continue to do this, I think we should probably focus on the scenic views from public streets or places. And I think we should be focusing on that element.
Okay. Councilmember Guthrie.
Let me start with a quick question to staff. If using the tenants as the tenant review as an example, if in fact there was no viewshed review, wouldn't really the very first thing that would have happened there is that they would have started building next door? There would actually have been no negotiation between the neighbors because the first action would have been the issuance of a building permit and the building of the building. So actually there would have been no opportunity for negotiation there.
That's true.
I guess my feeling on this, I think it was actually expressed by Mr. Keene last time, is that it's a messy process. I'd just as soon not do it, but I like the results. I actually think that for the most part, these have turned out to be reasonable negotiations. Yeah, it's kind of too bad that they often involve spending or sometimes involve spending quite a lot of money to make a very narrow argument, and it really comes down to a relatively subjective decision. But I do think that this is worth doing. That in fact we I won't say we necessarily have the responsibility, but that's part of what makes this a particularly good community, and that we can work these things out. And in other communities, they just whap up the building next door, and you have a bunch of unhappy people. When we actually are negotiating, as I've heard it once said, everybody's equally unhappy, and you know that's probably a better result than one happy person and one extremely unhappy person. So I'm inclined to leave it the way it is. If we could get to a viewshed review that was not subjective, that might be okay. I have to admit, I'm somewhat intrigued by the idea of what would happen if we built in all these setbacks. But it really has to do with, you know, where's the window and you know where's one house located on one lot relative to where the view is. So I'm inclined to stay with the process we have as long as it may not work very
well. And that's an area where I'm not prepared to go. But I would like to see if we could potentially, and I think of all the variables, and I'm not sure we can, but under the findings, I guess on page 4 of A, with maybe using a 50% example on the second story or something. And my first reaction is that could work out well, because in the case of like the what was their name?
Tenants.
Yeah, the tenants. In that home, there were multiple views, and it would be potentially that we could have not blocked one of the views with 50% of an increase. Although that may work in one, but if there's only one view and they block it with their 50% increase, then it's really hasn't done anything. So I'm not sure. I would love to figure out some way to come up with some kind of criteria that we could use to measure when it is really reasonable and when it's not reasonable, and I'm not sure we're going to be able to get there. If there's a way, and if there are any of the jurisdictions that are doing it where they're using it for private views, I would definitely support that. One of my thoughts was if we did get into more de-overlays, but not by necessarily having us dictate it, but actually having some community group meetings where the residents get together and they kind of define what they would like to see as far as view protection goes. And where that kind of comes into is we discussed it specifically on Leanna Drive when it's a strictly a single-story neighborhood right now. And when they had come in, one home had come in to do a two-story, we said no at the Planning Commission. Then it went to the council, and the council said no as well. But with the caveat, if the neighborhood gets together and at least 50% of the neighborhood wants to develop rules for going up, then they can go up. And I know that I have a friend that lives in there, and he's very much interested in that. And I think the neighborhood eventually will do that. And so that's a very defined neighborhood, and so I think that one's an easy one. I obviously, there's going to be other ones that are going to be a little bit harder, but that might be a way to go. It's not going to be something that we're going to fix overnight, but I think that might be a way that there'd be some kind of expectation within individual areas that people know what they can do. As far as the amended section on attachment one thing that I don't want to support is the second item, which would be basically requiring view shed on a vacant lot. And my reason for this is it's more of a timing issue. I think that if a neighborhood has two-story homes in it and there's a vacant lot there, while that maybe building a two-story home might impact somebody's view, I think there's an expectation for all the people around that this lot, if they had developed when everybody else developed their two stories, then they would have had the two-story with no issue. Where it gets a little gray is, well, obviously when you have single stories and two stories mixed in the same neighborhood, now is there the same expectation that, well, the home I bought next to was a single story, and so therefore that's the view that I'm going to have over top of their house. But I definitely am not in favor of starting to restrict lots that have not been built on. Whether it's a teardown, again, this is not a clean thing. I agree with Commissioner Keene that this is dirty work, but I think we're doing a pretty good job with it right now. And so if there's a way that we can clean it up a little bit to maybe try to get a little bit better vision on what the outcome could be for the applicants, that would be great. But I'm not inclined to do away with it. Thank you.
Every time a view shed issue comes up, I think back on the communities in the city that are covered by CCNRs where this very issue keeps coming up, obviously. And every time somebody wants to modify their residence or if they're building on a new lot, view sheds are crucial. And it's usually the homeowners association or the homeowners board that will get together and make a determination as to what private views are going to be preserved, which ones will be affected, so on and so forth. But the vast majority of our community is not covered by CCNRs or homeowners associations. So obviously when these issues come up, somebody has to step in and essentially perform a similar analysis on a case-by-case basis. The fact that no other city in the county is doing this and the county is not doing it to the degree that we are, I don't see that as being a factor at all. I don't mind being different than other cities, and I certainly don't mind being different than the county. I like the suggestion that if we are going to go to a neighborhood-specific design overlay or at least consider the uniqueness of certain neighborhoods as opposed to others, which I think is a good idea. I think the Mayor Pro Tem's comment of convening a neighborhood meeting so that we can get some feedback from those that would be directly affected would help us to design this and would certainly be in keeping with what we're trying to promote here, and that is continuing to involve the community in the shape of the future. Robbie made a comment about some of the criteria or some of the conditions that we might consider with regard to floor area ratio and green building. I would just assume not confuse the issue of view shed. If we're going to deal with view shed, let's deal with view shed and not mix it with other issues. I agree that to a degree we're not going to structure out all of the subjectiveness. I'm okay with that. I mean, I agree that that's our job. We look at these issues that come before us. We try and evaluate as best we can. We try and apply some common sense, and we have to make a determination. Some people like it, some people don't, but that's what we do. The example that that was used about the two parties that were involved, I think on, was that Lynn? Was it
Fairview, I think.
Was it Fairview? Yeah. If we were to have stepped back from that situation, I'm sure they could have resolved it in some fashion, either legally or in some other way. But the fact that only those two parties would have been negotiating, it may well have affected some of the surrounding neighbors. And those were concerns that I know we had when we looked at that particular situation. We would have had no way of keeping that from moving forward, perhaps in an adverse way. Maybe the two parties would have been satisfied, but what would it have done to the rest of the neighborhood? So I do believe that intervention is required, and I don't see any way around it. We're the body to do it. So I would like to see our view shed, and I just want to jump in with any.
I think I can read Rob's mind. I was trying to ease up on staff time, and now he's got a little bit more work to do. So sorry about that, Rob.
I was going to sort of echo that, and this has to do more with priorities. I think there's going to be, while I think this would be nice to do, this is a very big piece of work, and I think that there are perhaps some other code cleanup issues that are more important to this, and perhaps we can sort of look at that when we look at the code cleanup that we're talking about in order to completely implement the general plan, that we can prioritize this somewhere in there. It is my concern that, you know, this could suck up a lot of staff time and really take us away from some other important issues. So that would be my only concern about neighborhood meetings and every neighborhood to determine site standards and those kinds of things.
I'm okay with that for sure.
Yeah, well, I wasn't suggesting this is a front burner issue that we have to go out and do right now, but I'm saying that if we are going to unwrap it, then let's do it right. And I think involving the community at some point, and maybe we... You know, maybe, Steve, we go out and get some help. In fact, I see this as a good project for Cal Poly. So maybe we can figure out something there. Unless Teresa wants to do it all from, you know, point A to point Z.
Maybe another commendation in it for you, Teresa.
Okay. What do you need here? I don't see a motion here. I think we've pretty much voiced our position, right? Okay. Anything else for the good of the cause?
I was wondering if we should repeat it just to make sure we're all on the same page. It sounds like we're not not getting rid of it, not keeping it as is. We're going to probably try to go back and make some minor changes to make it a little more less subjective, develop some of the criteria things that Rob talks about, get the community involved in that, and go from there. But as far as prioritizing the work when we come back with our work plan for the other development code changes, we'll identify it in there as a recommendation of when we can get to it. Is that?
Yeah, and I really would maybe go to the urban planning department at Cal Poly. I see this as a good senior project for somebody.
Yeah,
we or think a group of kids.
Idea. Yeah, good idea.
Okay, then we'll move to item 12, city council member items. Anything? I don't see anything on the agenda. City manager items?
No, sir.
Okay, council communications, any announcements, correspondence?
I have a question. When will we have air conditioning? Because I'm sweating over here.
We're hoping by Friday.
Yeah, what Friday?
The electrician's coming in Friday to do some testing. So
I think we should make a motion that we wear Hawaiian shirts for the next meeting.
It'll be colder and cold.
Well, they're going to have the air conditioning fixed, and then you'll be chilly. And I wouldn't want you to come down with something and not be able to, you know, be here. The RENA figures that we have, something like 4,800 housing units. And if you recall, the last time it was pretty draconian. So we're going to be starting at our meeting tomorrow the whole process of looking at criteria and how we're going to kind of divide and distribute the those housing units among the jurisdictions in the county. So I just want to let you know that that those figures are in for San Luis Obispo County. Apparently, they housing and community development listened to some of our issues. Department of Finance did, in fact, recognize that the projected migration into San Luis Obispo County did not happen. Of course, we told them that it wasn't going to happen, but they wouldn't listen to us, and it just didn't materialize. And also, they've revised some of the growth figures for California as a whole. So that's the reason why the numbers are reduced. So I think with a little bit of creativity and in ingenuity, we can hopefully absorb whatever our share will be. I'll keep you posted on the criteria and how that goes. Okay, any staff communications?
Not this evening.
Okay, community comments and suggestions. Last opportunity. John, anything this evening? No? All right, that will take us to item 7, and I would entertain a motion to adjourn the meeting in honor of the families whose loved ones were lost during 911, and also all of our members of our armed forces currently serving overseas.
So moved.
Okay. We are adjourned.